Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, joined today by Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you doing?
Living in an insane world, what can you say? And it's a Monday. In an insane world, what can you do?
I feel that very powerfully, I think. We're also joined today by Mr. Chris Hutton. Chris, how are you?
Hi, Nick, Terence, doing well, thank you. At least it's raining in Joburg, so now we won't run out of water. There are silver linings.
Yeah, make sure
believe me, we can manage that. We can manage it, you know.
make sure to go and collect your water outside before it runs out in the taps, or if it has already run out in the taps, make sure to go and collect it outside. Anyway, survival advice aside, let's talk about our first news story of today, and that is... Well, this is a recurring theme this year. Another threat to the stability of the government of national unity. This time, however, I think it's about something that is perhaps a little bit less ideological. So let's get into it. There's reporting over the weekend, I think it was mostly in the Sunday Times, that Finance Minister Enoch Godongwana is going to be including major tax hikes when he tables the budget to Parliament on Wednesday. Economists, according to reporting by News24, have projected that the budget is likely to show that there was a revenue shortfall in terms of tax collection, and that there are unanticipated additional spending pressures, and that this means that there's going to be a rise in government debt if they don't institute new taxes. There's a number of things that have caused these problems, everything from the public sector wage bill to ongoing misspending of money to court orders, which have ordered increases in the in various grants. And the bottom line is that because personal income tax is at a sort of is no longer generating more and more money when you raise it because people already tax so highly, and because company tax is already at a level that is making South Africa uncompetitive, it looks like there is going to be a rise in VAT, value-added tax that we pay on sale of all non-essential goods. This has made the DA very upset, who actually campaigned in the election on increasing the number of goods that were exempt from VAT. DA people speaking to the Sunday Times said that they will fight any tax increases and push for a budget that prioritizes sustainable growth and fiscal responsibility, and that they would not vote for a bill that increases, a budget rather, that increases VAT. There's also been outrage about the increase in VAT, a potential increase in VAT from groups like COSATU. And apparently even some ANC cabinet ministers are not particularly keen on the idea either. And I think they're right to be concerned. We were talking before the show about the country's financial situation, and we've been talking on the show for a long time about how South Africa doesn't have great financial resources to pull from. And there's the kind of cliche is the country's running out of runway. Well, I think when you have to start raising VAT again and again, we have actually run out of runway. No government wants to do something like raise VAT, particularly not a sort of populist left-leaning party like the ANC. But there is no other option right now. And this is exactly the kind of thing that is politically very dangerous for them. Personally, it divides their own coalition. There are a lot of people inside the ANC, including, for example, COSATU, but also I'm sure there's others who are extremely upset at the idea of raising VAT. And also, VAT is a tax that is paid by basically all South Africans, except maybe people who only buy bread. But I don't even know if there are people who can literally only afford bread or pap or something. And so it taxes the poorest of the poor as much as it taxes the rich, which is exactly why one of the reasons we've actually called for reducing VAT significantly. But Terence, let me start with you. I mean, I guess this is because the ANC has been unable to decide how to resolve the spending problem, right? It hasn't been able to properly cut spending. It hasn't been able to grow the economy. So what's left but a VAT increase? Terence, you're muted, sir.
Yeah, this is unfortunately where the bill comes due. I remember there were discussions about this as long ago as the 1990s. And this was always about, you can do this to sort of extend the coverage of your tax net. But as you say, it does hit poorer people particularly hard, particularly on their discretionary spending. So, you know, while it's not going to want to affect the price of bread or whatever, you know, the question is, you know, do you want to buy a Coke or something like that? You know, that's, you know, it's the very minor pleasures that you can afford all of a sudden become pricier. And yeah, I think this is one where there would be enormous blowback. And I think the stock response is, oh, well, you must tax the rich. Unfortunately, the rich have been heading for the door. Middle class are up to their eyeballs. We need a far bigger economy to sort of cushion this. Or, you know, as Chris was saying before the show, maybe you could actually introduce some changes. I mean, it's a revolutionary thought. And maybe we could sort of hold back on things like that 100 billion rand BE boondoggle that our esteemed president was talking about in Cerner. You know, it's just money.
No, exactly right. And just an idea of the few items that are tax exempt or VAT exempt, things like brown bread, maize meal, SAMP, millet rice, milk powder, vegetables, fruit, milk, cultured milk, eggs, paraffin, I think is VAT exempt as well. Chris, what do you make of this? I mean, you were talking to me about before the show about the amount of money we're already spending on paying the interest on South Africa's national debt. Do you want to expand a bit on that?
Yeah, so that particular line item has been increasing over the last few years. Of course, the government increased its spending and increased the deficit more so during the couple of years of COVID and the government associated lockdowns in terms of support and other forms of stimulus for the economy. But at this point in time, the wedge, as it were, of the debt servicing costs continues to grow, and that presses down on other categories of spending. So your things like healthcare, education, military spending, of course, which we know is already in the ICU. When you have to deal with your debt servicing costs, it depresses and results in cuts to other forms of spending, where if one is of the disposition that you need a state to do at least some of these things and provide some services, that's where the spending should be. So on things like infrastructure, some forms of social welfare, etc. As of 2023-24, South Africa's just paying off the debt and the debt servicing costs. For every rand that the government collected in revenue, more than 20 cents had to go towards debt servicing costs. So you take that out, you take, for example, when the government does spend on infrastructure where projects are delayed, you've got things like BEE premiums, you've got other delays in terms of increasing costs. All of that then impacts on government's revenue streams at the end of the day. And when you don't have a growing economy, you've got a very narrow tax base. You've got, both in terms of individual taxpayers, but also companies, fewer and fewer companies responsible for a larger share of government's tax take. And if you then implement sorts of policies that either directly push individuals and companies away out of the country or just create uncertainty, they will try and find some more stability and certainty elsewhere. So, of course, the most recent prime example of this is the Expropriation Act, where South Africa almost, instead of sending signals that we want to keep capital here, both domestic and foreign, we want to push it away as much as possible. And then that produces this sort of very tight fiscal situation in which the government finds itself. This, of course, also filters down in terms of provincial spending, so cuts to provincial health departments, education departments, etc., where at the end of the day, it impacts the most on those who can't afford, for example, to send their kids to private school, to afford private healthcare facilities, all of that sort of thing. So this is very harsh medicine that the government has to take. One very much hopes, for example, that the DA holds this line on tax increases, because kicking the can further down the road just incentivizes the wrong sorts of behaviors, the wrong policies, the wrong ideas, where this is the situation the government chose to put itself in. The situation last year, we tapped our gold, some of our gold reserves and use that to pay off some elements of debt and deal with some of that. But you can't keep doing that because it sends a negative signal about fiscal responsibility, which South Africa does have in its favor. Our fiscal institutions like the National Treasury Reserve Bank, SARS, unfortunately, show that they're quite capable and good at what their jobs are. But they can only do so much to shore up bad policy by the rest of the government. So for as long as we're in this low growth sort of trap, this is the difficult balancing act. And it's not like government can't get out of this. You just have to make very difficult political decisions.
Right, exactly. So, Terence, it really seems like this is because the ANC has tried to have its cake and eat it too for a very long time. We'll pursue things that are destructive to the economy, and we'll also extract things for patronage. We'll just kind of treat the fiscus as though it's not the biggest deal in the world. And this has particularly happened. The ANC was very fiscally responsible in the 2000s, and that changed when Jacob Zuma took control of the ANC, at which point I wouldn't say the brakes came off, but the brakes started being used a lot less on our spending, starting kind of around 2009. And that has built over the years to the point where now, you know, we're facing the consequences of the poor choices that have been made over the last 10 years. Any final thoughts on this one?
Yeah, look, I have a slightly different view on that, in the sense that I think that Treasury has shown a great deal of resilience to keeping, you know, to working within the parameters that it's had. And I think unfortunately we were sort of creeping towards this, you know, simply by running down the capacity of the government to function properly. South Africa's problems have never been a lack of resources. There's been a chronic misapplication of them and the incentivization of perverse behavior. You know, just imagine, for instance, if the something like the Madupi and Kusile power stations had come in on time and on budget. You know, forget the shenanigans that went into commissioning them and whatever. But, you know, just imagine we weren't paying sort of three times what we needed to. You know, that would have meant a lot less pain. It would have meant, you know, more available energy, and it would have, you know, just meant a better economic environment.
That's exactly right. Misspending of resources is actually a much bigger problem, as you say, than lack of resources. And I think we're seeing that here in the fiscus overall, particularly the public sector wage bill, which is this giant behemoth that the ANC, I think, in the past couple of years has tried to slow down, but is not having an enormous amount of success in doing so because it's not able to make those hard political choices. Go ahead.
Just very, very last point. Just in the global context, where it looks like some of President Trump's policies will shore up the value of the US dollar, that will, of course, impact then downstream on emerging market currencies like the rand. So if we don't domestically do what's necessary to build up the value of the rand, it's more exposed should that particular route continue. So should interest rates remain higher for longer, the cost of paying down your debt, either as an individual or as a government, those costs are higher for longer. So it places countries like South Africa in a much more tenuous position going forward. But those things are within our ability to change. So we can't control, obviously, what the US Fed does, what the Trump administration does. But the more you make the wrong domestic fiscal choices, like just the more brittle you are and the more exposed when things then do turn against you.
Yes. Okay, so I guess related to bad economic policy that has put us in this position, let's talk a little bit about the Expropriation Act. And one of the things I wanted to highlight here was the editorial, I think it was in the Sunday Times over the weekend, which was a very frustrating read to me for a variety of reasons. And Terence, I'd like you to speak about this editorial, but first let me read sections of it. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I'm going to read a significant chunk of it. I have edited out pieces here, so do go check it out if you can. The title is "Expropriation Act or Not, Land Reform is the Real Issue." President Cyril Ramaphosa's assurance in Parliament this week that South Africa will never allow forced removals again in this country is to be welcomed. That no one has been deprived of their land under the democratic dispensation of South Africa is a testament to the durability and guarantees of private property provided in the Constitution. Yet it is also true that the government's land reform efforts thus far have been a dismal failure. The evidence strongly suggests that merely replacing owners and not supporting the new ones with expertise and the wherewithal is a shortcut to disaster that has given land reform a bad name and threatened food security. While land reform should be a national priority in South Africa, this has not been the case, with the issue relegated to a junior ministry. The result is that most farmland is still owned by whites 30 years after the end of apartheid, which is surely not what the authors of the Constitution had envisaged. Looking beyond the more, sorry, goes on to say that the question of whether the bill hurts investment is debatable, but that no law in of itself is adequate for the demanding task of land reform. It will require a joint effort by the government, private sector and organized agriculture to bring about a situation where ownership is broadly reflective of the population and with the effect of enhancing, not imperiling, the nation's food security. If, as its critics suggest, the Expropriation Act is a populist sop thrown to the masses as a substitute for meaningful and large-scale land reform, it represents yet another missed opportunity for the country. Terence, your thoughts on this editorial?
Okay, there has been a lot said in recent years about disinformation and misinformation and the need for fact-checking and expertise and whatever, and I have seen very little evidence of that around this whole debate. Can one call it a debate when it's based on false premises? This is not a Land Expropriation Act. It is an Expropriation Act. This is not about land reform. It is about the ability of the state to take property. Now, those people who are worried about, X, now if you're on X, I can't help you. Those who are worried about Elon Musk, those who are worried about whether Meta is employing appropriate fact checkers, and whether the Baba Rasputin Reincarnation for Peace newsletter thinks COVID is a hoax, can we, when commenting on things right in front of us, can we please just read the, actually read the document? Okay. So, no, this is not about land reform. Does it present an opportunity? Well, all this can do is it can deprive people of their property. That's it. That's the whole nine yards of what this does. It does not address the failure to provide adequate post-settlement support. And this idea that this is a, what did they say? It's an issue that should have received priority. Really? Then explain to me why the ANC didn't even campaign on it in 1994. Because their own polling showed that there was virtually no interest in land reform. Land reform may mean a great deal to the editor of the Sunday Times in Rosebank, I believe. As we know, not exactly an agricultural hub. But for most South Africans in a country that is two-thirds urbanized, land reform, the restoration of the land to the people, is just not really top of mind. And that is basically why this did not enjoy that sort of priority. And the priority it was given was ineptly handled. It was overseen by people who had very little exposure to agriculture. And this allowed all sorts of shysters to stick their fingers in, including some from the historic agricultural community, just by the by. Point is that sticky fingers can be attached onto all sorts of DNA. But no, by all means, let's get serious about it. Let's start with, what is the factual basis? Once we realize that land reform, certainly in this agrarian sense, is actually a fairly limited niche issue, we can start, it becomes possible to solve. However, when it's elevated to this political crisis point, I don't think it is possible to solve it.
I remember that even the so that there's definitely a kind of section of the land is always meant to kind of represent. It's often been like almost abstracted now to the point where it means like social injustice almost, rather than actually being, as you say, about, you know, agricultural land, which is not something. There are definitely some people out there who would probably like to have access to more land to farm this or that, but the vast majority of South Africans want jobs and houses, and they want to be wealthy, and they want to live in cities, and we can see that from migration patterns, and we can see that from people's sort of actions that they express. Even the EFF, what did its slogan? I mean, the EFF has always talked about the need for radical land
and sort of jobs thing, but, now.
Yes, but it was when one actually looked at the sort of campaigning, it was very much our jobs, all in caps. And then it was sort of, and land now. Because, as you say, Terrence, the people of this country actually don't care about land reform nearly as much as academics and editors and activists do. Chris, the other thing that frustrates me about this editorial was also just sort of, it doesn't actually engage with anything directly written in the bill. It sort of just talks about the debate in this kind of meta way, and then just says, "Oh," and it doesn't even do what its, you know, what its proponents have kind of said that it would be good at doing, which, as Terrence has explained, is actually completely missing the point about what this legislation does. But as for the problems that have caused the most concern, things like nil compensation, on an open-ended list of reasons for public interest, that's just not examined at all. How can you have a debate about this issue when you're not even willing to like sort of look into any of the details whatsoever?
So two things. Yeah, if you use very open-ended terms or references when you debate, you can't then be said to have succeeded or failed on the debate term. So it just keeps shifting the goalposts. It's more malleable, and that makes it maybe easier, maybe for some, from an intellectual point of view, to then just, you know, shift things to where you want it from an emotional point of view. And that's the second aspect. So I don't want to try and make tenuous links here, but we've seen it exposed in South Africa's, application of its foreign policy, if we accept that there is some sort of coherent foreign policy in the last few weeks, exposed in the situation in the DRC and, of course, on the global stage, where it's more about vibes and emotions and feelings versus having to deal with reality. So here, in this particular instance, you can talk about these grand terms, you can talk emotionally, you can say this is what it's going to do and what it's about, what this piece of legislation is about, but that doesn't reflect the reality on the ground for South Africans, which is what the Institute polling shows year after year, and polling by other organizations. But that, of course, means if you take the signals from your reality, you might then start to question your own ideology, your worldview. You might then need to reassess some things, and it might make you very uncomfortable. It might make you more productive and actually useful for society, but, you know, that's a difficult period of introspection to deal with. So I think there's a few things going on in the background, at least psychologically and philosophically, and it doesn't really further. Just if we're talking purely sort of pragmatic policy application and legislation, it doesn't help, even if you assume that most South Africans wanted quote-unquote land. Okay, what are you doing to investigate why programs to give South Africans title deeds have failed? Where have the billions given to the Department of Land Reform, a lot of them, where has that gone? Ask those real questions if you accept the premises that land is this,
right,
this burning hunger in the country.
And why have the land reform projects that have happened had such an incredibly shocking rate of failure across the board? But Terrence, it's very weird sometimes. I mean, the phrase used in this editorial is a populist sop thrown to the masses. It's weird that you see an issue where populism is so unpopular.
Yeah, well, you have a situation where ideology is, in a sense, more real than reality. Where a very narrow elite talks to itself and becomes convinced that this is you know, this really represents everyone. And I think, you know, this plays out all over the world. I think in every sort of open society. But yeah, you know, to the extent that we have a land issue in South Africa, it's predominantly an urban one. It's predominantly about housing. But frankly, it's not the quantum of land. It's about, you know, how you provide people with housing units, in which worldwide experience shows basically you have to go up, not out. So yeah, you know, your patch of earth. I think that frankly that those concerns belong to previous epochs.
Well, I mean, so does Marxism. Another wonderful gift to us from the 1800s. But apparently, in South Africa's intellectual circles, it refuses to die the death that it has been destined for many years. Anyway, let's talk about our last story today, and this is about political party funding. And I think I made a reference to this issue last week. But Action SA, and I think also the DA, have said that they want more enforcement on the issue of accountability on party political funding. Well, why are they raising this issue? If you look at a number of South Africa's big political parties, most especially MK and the EFF, but I think MK is perhaps the most obvious example here, they are required by law to publicly disclose donations. I think it's above 100,000 rand in a quarter to the public, so that everyone can see where their money is coming from. MK has able to put on massive events. They're able to fill stadiums. They're able to do this and that. And this was all before they got their seats in parliament, which come with a stipend for the party. They were able to, you know, really kind of compete on the national stage, and the EFF too, right? They famously hired buses from across the country to fill an entire stadium. And yet MK has only apparently had 300,000 rand in donations. MK is also allegedly facing a problem within the party of claims that 40 million rand was stolen from the party's coffers. How do they have 40 million rand to be stolen if 300,000 rand is all they got from donations? So Action SA is basically saying we need this is really weird. The IEC is not equipped to be able to actually investigate this stuff, and that there should be real consequences for political parties that just completely ignore the funding laws. I think the DA, Action SA, and some of the other smaller parties, thinking the Freedom Front Plus, I think the IFP as well, the UDM, they've all been pretty good at actually complying with the law. But when it comes to the sort of ANC, EFF, MK crowd, especially MK, it seems as though the law does not apply. I don't know, Chris, do you think I'm being unfair?
I would never accuse you of being unfair, Mr. Lorimer. But there is maybe a certain element of, what's the word, selectivity going on at this point in time. I mean, I think that's important to keep in mind as well. As South African politics fragments slightly more, you'll see more incentives for this kind of thing. But given just in the last few weeks, what some of the polling indicates around support levels for the ANC, maybe we'll reverse back to where things aren't as fragmented, given how some of their opponents are performing and scoring own goals. So that'll also determine maybe how emotional some of these debates and discussions are, and what are some of the incentives or drivers behind why some of this would be advocated for. I think not from a scientific point of view, but purely, you know, self-interest.
Terence, your thoughts?
Yeah, look, I think that party funding has been intrinsic to pretty much all the major scandals that we've had over the years. I do understand there's a certain reticence to set the bar too low for what people receive, what parties receive, because, you know, a small business, you know, that, you know, for which a contract of 200,000 rand from the local municipality could be a huge amount of money, might not want to put itself in the spotlight for a donation of 10,000 rand. So, you know, there is that. Yeah, I think that sort of radical disclosure would need to follow would need to follow a fundamental shift in our political culture to one that is a great deal more open and is a great deal more accommodating to pluralism.
No, that's a very fair point. And I think this is kind of what irritated the... I know some DA people told me that very irritated by the Party Funding Act initially is that they said, you know, now we're going to have to publicly declare all of our donors, which is going to just mean they're going to be targeted by the government and punished, and people may, you know, try to boycott them or something like that. And now they're even more annoyed because they have had to comply, basically talking about who their donors are. And then other parties just seem to be ignoring it and doing as they did previously, as though the law hadn't been passed, which is this kind of silly double standards.
And I imagine there is a river of dirty money that's sort of running, through front companies and just
exactly
that, it's just happening off the books.
Exactly. So I think it's been a while since I praised Action SA, but I think this is a good issue to be pushing into the public eye. Anyway, with that said, thank you very much, everyone, for watching. We hope you found the show interesting. We will be back tomorrow with the Daily Friend Wrap in the afternoon. Hope you all have a wonderful day. Cheers, everyone.